will regulated militia be necessary to the security of a free state? The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program. I can see the rooster staring at me through the window right now. I just know it's going to happen at some point. But until the cock crows, we are going to talk, well, even when the cock starts crowing, we are going to talk about the today, specifically, the oral arguments before the Seventh Circuit in a case called Schoenthal versus Raul. This is a challenge to the ban on concealed carry on public transit in the state of Illinois. You'd think this would be a pretty straightforward argument, right? However, I gotta say, the oral arguments themselves, a lot of time and attention taken up, not on the merits of the case, but on whether or not the plaintiffs here actually have standing to sue. And the preview, Bloomberg Law wrote that Chicago's mass transit gun ban faces scrutiny under the history test. And that is true. There was some history discussed during the oral arguments today. But before we got there, there was a lot of discussion, and interspersed with that history, a lot of discussion again about whether or not the plaintiffs had standing to sue. The state of Illinois, the attorneys for the state of Illinois, arguing that the plaintiffs do not have standing here. They said whatever happens here, whether the Seventh Circuit upholds the law in question or throws out the law in question, those no gun signs are going to remain in place because the transit systems themselves prohibit firearms, noting that there's also a trespassing statute that prevents, supposedly, individuals from bringing firearms on board a CTA or a Metro property. Now, the Firearms Policy Coalition, who is part of Schoenthal versus Raul, their attorney had this question asked when it was their turn to come before the judges. John Ohlendorf, I believe, is the attorney's name, who was representing the plaintiffs there. That's the wrong tweet. There we go. It says, a judge asked to address the standard and redressable injury. Our lawyer notes that it is the threat of prosecution under this specific law that is the injury. The judge pushes back that the trespassing laws still leave injury. So how does this case actually fix it? Ohlendorf explained how each of these statutes is separate and must be dealt with accordingly, but added that even if you believe that removal of this statute doesn't bind the prosecution for going after, you know, a lawful concealed carrier for violating the trespassing, right, or for charging with trespassing, Ohlendorf said it would be bold for a state attorney to come into court and charge somebody with a different crime for carrying after the courts ruled a carry ban unconstitutional. I think that is very much the case. Now, whether or not the Seventh Circuit panel adopts that common sense approach, as opposed to getting lost in the legal weeds, I think is another question. But again, how on earth, if there are overlapping statutes here, how on earth are you supposed to get redress of grievances unless you are challenging all of these specific statutes, in which case, you know, a court's probably going to go back and say, listen, this is too broad a lawsuit. You've got to challenge this specific statute right here. So I think what Ohlendorf was saying is accurate, not only from a legal perspective, but again, from a realistic perspective. You know, this is the best way. If this law is found to be unconstitutional, as it should be, the ban on carrying a firearm on public transportation, despite what the state of Illinois claimed, not analogous to some of these specific sensitive places that were laid out in Bruin. If the court finds that that law that prohibits the carrying of firearms on public transit is unconstitutional, then yes, if somebody is arrested for trespassing on CTA property because they are in possession of a firearm, they've got a concealed carry license, but they're still carrying in a place where the CTA says, ah, you can't bring that gun, that is going to be a different challenge. But you will be able to cite not only a Second Amendment argument more generally, you would be able to cite Schoenthal versus Raul, showing that, yes, the courts have found a ban on carrying in these places to be a violation of my Second Amendment rights. So if the ban itself is unconstitutional, then the charge of trespassing for doing the same thing must also be a violation of our Second Amendment rights. Now, when it did come to the merits, the state's argument was really, I think, really weak. So the first argument is that, well, you know, if you look back at what railroads did in the 1800s, a lot of them banned carrying of firearms there on railroads. But even if you don't want to look specifically at railroads, you know, there's this historical tradition of banning firearms in crowded public places. That is what the state of Illinois said was the limiting principle to the right to carry, that the governments, whether at the federal level or the state level, could ban the carrying of firearms in any place that might be full of a lot of people. Now, the Supreme Court already said, no, that's not the standard. They told the state of New York, you can't ban concealed carry across the island of Manhattan just because a lot of people live there. They pointed to a couple of specific areas, right? Legislatures, courthouses, polling places. Those are the three areas that were explicitly named as sensitive places where guns could be banned at the time of the founding. And again, going back to the Firearms Policy Coalition's live tweeting of the oral arguments, they know that the judge stopped the state of Illinois attorney as he was making this argument and noted that the ban that the state leans on regarding railroads, those were private company rules. She asked how the state balances that. And the state says, well, the railroads weren't really private. They were this sort of, you know, quasi-public entity. And then again, the state brought up a crowding as a justification for carry bans on multiple occasions, says the FPC social media writer said, this guy really hates people being able to defend themselves in crowded spaces. And again, that's not the standard. That can't be the standard. The standard that the government, that the Supreme Court kind of laid out is that, you know, you can't simply call someplace sensitive and say, all right, well, guns are banned there because it's sensitive, right? There needs to be an actual showing that the government treats this as a sensitive place. And this is something that the plaintiff's attorney, John Ohlendorf, brought up. He said, you know, we can tell when the government really treats a place as sensitive. Right. There are going to be magnetometers there. There's going to be some sort of security there. But in the case of the CTA, the Chicago Transit Authority, you know, the police might be there, but not in any larger numbers than they are on the city streets. And by the way, I mean, this is something we've talked about a lot at BearingArms.com. There is no shortage of violent crime on the Chicago Transit Authority. You've got robberies, you've got stabbings, you've got shootings in these gun-free zones. Criminals don't care. If anything, they feel emboldened by the fact that there are going to be a lot of unarmed victims in these locations. But more broadly, Ohlendorf's point, I think, is accurate. And this is something that we have again seen in state after state after the Bruin decision, where anti-gun governments come in and say, you know what, we're going to declare all of these places sensitive, even though we don't really treat them as sensitive places, right? Public parks, I think, is a perfect example of this. Parks are sensitive, according to, you know, the government in New Mexico and in Colorado and in New York, because lots of people gather there, and there are kids there. So a public park is analogous to a playground, which is analogous to a school, and, you know, schools presumptively can ban firearms, so therefore you can ban firearms in public parks because they're sensitive. When was the last time you saw a metal detector at a public park? When was the last time you got patted down when you walked into a public park? When was the last time you saw armed guards stationed at the entrances of public parks? When was the last time you saw an entrance, a formal entrance to a public park, as opposed to an open green space where people can just wander on and off, you know, anytime they want? There is nothing about a public park that makes it particularly sensitive in terms of how the government treats people in that location. And the same is true of public transit. And not just in the state of Illinois, not just in the city of Chicago. If you get on a bus in New York City, you don't go through a metal detector. There's no police officer stationed in every subway car. There's no magnetometer in every subway station. It is sensitive in name only, just quite frankly, as it is gun-free in name only. The Seventh Circuit also wrestled with, what is the proper time frame to look at here? Do you look at 1791? Do you look at 1868? Do you look at both? Do you give more weight to one or the other? State of Illinois wants 1868. There were more gun laws on the books in 1868 than there were in 1791. There were more restrictions, generally speaking, on the right to carry than there were in 1791. So the state has an easier time arguing that this public transit ban is applicable under the Second Amendment if they can point to statutes that were put in place in or around 1868. And a lot of these cases, we're talking about 1888, 1898, early 1900s. Ohlendorf, the plaintiff's attorney, said that the Supreme Court left it open. Didn't provide a concrete answer as to what time period to look at. But he suggested that the Seventh Circuit itself, both pre- and post-Bruin, in other cases, have pointed to 1791 being the appropriate time period to at least give the most weight to, not 1868. If you're looking at what the original meaning of the Second Amendment was, well, you want to look to the time in which the Second Amendment was ratified, written and ratified. And that would be 1791, not 1868. Now, again, Ohlendorf's argument is that it really, if, even if you want to look at 1868, there is no national tradition of barring lawful carry on public transportation. Again, private companies may have had their own rules, but there were no real statutes to look at. I'm curious to see what the Seventh Circuit does here. And this is an issue that, you know, listen, I live in rural Virginia. I can't remember the last time I was on public transit, probably 13 years ago when I lived in Northern Virginia. I used to take my kids into Washington, D.C., would go to the Smithsonian Museums and would ride the D.C. Metro. So this is not an issue that impacts me personally. But this is an issue that impacts millions of Americans. Because if you can tell them, hey, listen, you can't carry a gun when you're on a subway car. You can't carry a gun when you're on the L in Chicago. That means that they can't carry a gun on their way to the L. They can't carry a gun once they get off the subway. They are essentially deprived of their right to keep and bear arms throughout their day. And again, there are millions of Americans who rely on public transportation to get around. And if you tell those millions of Americans, because you use public transportation, because you don't have a private car, you can't exercise your right to carry, that's a huge problem. And I think that is a glaring infringement on their right to keep and bear arms. It is a limitation on the Second Amendment that turns it from a right into a privilege by denying that right to so many Americans who live in urban areas. And frankly, you know, I would say so many Americans who maybe are on the lower end of the economic ladder. But I mean, in places, and that may be true, I guess. I don't know the statistics. I don't know if the, you know, per capita income of a public transit user is, you know, higher or lower than somebody who drives a private car, their own personal vehicle. Because, you know, again, in cities like New York or Chicago, especially places like New York, public transportation, I think, is the de facto way of getting around. That or, you know, taking a taxi or an Uber. But most people don't have cars in New York City. Many people in Chicago don't have their own personal mode of transportation. They rely on the city to get them from point A to point B. And again, if those folks, that entire class of Americans who depend on public transportation to get around, if that entire class of Americans can be deprived of their fundamental civil right to bear arms for self-defense, how can the Second Amendment not be a second-class right? So I think Ohlendorf did a really good job today of challenging the statute in question, explaining why, even if there are other statutes that might come into play, it is important to knock this particular statute down on constitutional grounds. Then we can go back and deal with the other ones later. Seventh Circuit has been pretty hostile to our right to keep and bear arms. Seventh Circuit has upheld pre-Bruin bans on so-called assault weapons. Post-Bruin, they have denied injunctive relief to those folks challenging the Protect Illinois Communities Act, which encompasses both a ban on modern sporting rifles and large capacity magazines. So from that perspective, I am not particularly hopeful that the panel today is going to rule in favor of the plaintiffs. And by the way, the district court did rule in favor of the plaintiffs. It was the state of Illinois appealing this, but it was a fairly limited and narrow decision. So the named plaintiffs in this case were told that they could carry a firearm on public transportation. Again, subject, I guess, to the trespassing law, right? But not everybody with a concealed carry license in the state of Illinois could do the same. So the Seventh Circuit could uphold that decision, but again, keep it so narrow that the four plaintiffs are the only ones impacted here. But that would open up the door to a broader challenge. And I don't, again, based on just nothing more than the Seventh Circuit's history in handling Second Amendment cases, I don't know how likely it is that that's going to happen. You know, ultimately, as with all of these issues, this is going to get kicked up to the Supreme Court one way or the other. And then the question becomes whether the Supreme Court has the appetite to address this case, and again, to provide relief to the millions of Americans who live in places right now where their right to keep and bear arms is curtailed completely if they are dependent on public transportation to get around. So we'll keep our eyes open. I would not expect a decision quickly. I mean, you know, we've actually seen some cases in the appellate courts kick around for a year or more. I hope that that's not the case here with Schoenthal versus Raul. But I would be very surprised if we got a decision, let's say, before Labor Day. I'd actually be pretty surprised if we got a decision before Thanksgiving. But fingers crossed, we do get one maybe between Labor Day and Thanksgiving, or even Halloween, right? All right, moving on now to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We'll start there. Again, not really a recidivist report. I might have to change the name of this here, just to the what the heck were they thinking segment. Here's the headline. Ex-volunteer with Ramsey County Sheriff's Office Youth Program gets probation for sexually abusing a girl. He told police he became a volunteer with the Youth Plus program because he wanted to become a police officer. Not because he wanted to molest teenage girls. That, I guess, was just a bonus for Pao Ji Vu, 27 years old, of St. Paul, Minnesota, who pleaded guilty last month to an amended charge of gross misdemeanor, fifth-degree criminal sexual conduct after reaching a plea deal that also included dismissing a felony count of attempted fourth-degree criminal sexual conduct. So again, felony charge downgraded to a misdemeanor via a plea deal here. And Vu gets to avoid prison, gets to avoid jail time. Ramsey County District Judge David Brown accepted that plea deal, stayed a nearly one-year sentence. According to the Pioneer Press, the victim and father agreed with the plea deal, which is, I think, the only mitigating factor here. But I do wonder why that was the case. Was this simply about her being unwilling or not really wanting to testify in open court? Or is she really okay with Vu getting probation? She wrote a statement for Brown for the judge to read prior to Vu's sentencing, but she did not want it read aloud in court. Pioneer Press says, according to the criminal complaint, the girl's older sister wrote the abuse to St. Paul police on January 30th, 2024. She said that the girl had attended the youth program 2 to 3 times a week over the summer, that Vu, who was her coach, often provided transportation for her, but they began noticing that she was spending a lot of time going to the program during off hours. Her family discovered that Vu was taking her to a workout facility in the evenings, which caused concern. Girl told police that Vu touched her inner thigh 5 times while also trying to touch her groin before she told him to stop. She said on 2 or 3 occasions, Vu grabbed her hand to try to get her to touch his crotch, which she refused to do. She said Vu also tried to kiss her. All when Vu was driving her somewhere or at a gym not associated with the youth program. Complaint reads, the girl said that as the touching occurred, she felt like crying. She was also scared and questioned herself as to why she was going with him. She said that she spent time with Vu outside of his volunteering time, and she felt obligated to do so because he had bought her volleyball shorts, a gym membership, food, and other things. Grooming, in other words. He was grooming her, and she felt guilty. Well, he's doing all this stuff for me. I mean, I guess I got it right. I feel terribly for this child. And I understand that maybe her reluctance to testify in court left prosecutors with their hands tied. If you don't have your star witness, if you don't have somebody who can testify directly to this abuse, instead you're relying on, you know, the older sister. Maybe she doesn't even want to testify. Maybe the hands were tied here. But I have to say, I'm sad that if that was the case, because this is how abusers go on to commit more abuse. Because victims, again, understandably, don't want to recount what happened to them in open court. They don't want to have to relive that experience. They don't want the eyes on them as they're testifying. I get and I understand all of that. It is a terrible thing to do. And it requires a great deal of courage and bravery to sit there on the witness stand and to testify about these things. I just hope that, again, the soft sentence given to Mr. Vu does not lead him to abuse again in the future. All right, on to today's armed citizen story from Baltimore, Maryland. Rabbi pulls out gun, scaring off assailants who assaulted him in attempted carjacking. I gotta say, I am so thrilled about this. You know, and I wrote about this at Bearing Arms Wednesday morning. Baltimore, according to Mayor Brandon Scott, actually, right now in 2025, through the end of May, the fewest number of homicides in Baltimore in recorded history to the start of a year. That's great news. Now, we were told a couple of years ago after Bruin and the demise of Maryland's May issue laws that Maryland's going to become a more dangerous place, right? Crime is going to go up. In fact, the gun control advocate said it was going to happen in all of these May issue states. And that really hasn't happened. Crime has dropped pretty dramatically in Baltimore. Not just homicides, non-fatal shootings as well. This is great news. And again, it's evidence that lawful gun owners are not the problem. It's violent criminals. And when you focus on violent criminals, you focus on those high-risk offenders, good things happen. When you allow people like this rabbi to protect themselves, even better things can happen. And in this case, a rabbi who had just gotten home from synagogue, according to a local city council member, had not even changed yet, was taken out of the trash and was accosted by two individuals who tried to carjack him, or at least get the keys to his vehicle. The rabbi drew his handgun, and the assailants took off running. I'm not sure if the he pointed the gun. He did not have to fire any shots, by the way. Just the presence of that firearm was enough to send the assailants on their way. They have not been taken into custody. No suspect information has been released. But again, based on the circumstances here, the fact that this rabbi had just gotten home, and not even changed out of his clothes, that leads me to believe that the rabbi not only had a handgun qualification permit, which would allow him to keep a gun in the home, but also had a concealed carry license. There are about 200,000 Maryland residents who have a carry license, compared to, I think, about 50,000 before Bruin, when you had to show a justifiable need. And hey, listen, I live in Baltimore, Maryland, where there at that point had been 300 homicides a year for the last 8 years. That wasn't a good enough reason to get a concealed carry license. You had to be able to document a specific ongoing threat against your life in order for you to obtain a carry license, or you had to work in, you know, a job that required you to take a lot amount of cash to the bank at night to make deposits, or maybe you were a jeweler and you carried jewelry around. But the average everyday citizen who said, listen, I live in a bad neighborhood, I want to be able to protect myself and my family. No. You don't get to, not with a gun. That was what Maryland's May issue law did. And again, since the demise of that May issue regime, the establishment of a shall issue regime, Maryland still doesn't make it easy. I mean, you've got a 16-hour training course to get a concealed carry license. You've got, as I mentioned, that handgun qualification permit. So you got to go take training and pass a live fire test before you can even keep a gun in your home, which to me is insane. That's one of those laws that the Supreme Court has let stand for now anyway. And then there are a number of sensitive places in Maryland, right, where it's simply off limits for lawful gun owners. Thankfully, houses of worship, not among them. So, you know, rabbis, pastors, they imams, they can decide on their own if they want to make their property a gun-free zone, but they don't have to under the law. And in this case, again, sounds like the rabbi may have had his firearm with him when he arrived home. And I'm glad that he did, because, again, this could have ended up very differently had he not been able to protect himself. Finally today, our good deed of the day. In the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. A man in Boston who helped an officer under attack. By the way, I had another story about Boston at Bearing Arms today, talking about the violent crime on the increase in the city there. In fact, homicides up 100% compared to this time last year. Non-fatal shootings up nearly 50% compared to this time last year. And of course, Governor Maura Healey said when she signed Chapter 135 into law last year and then attached that emergency preamble to it a couple months later. Oh, this is going to improve public safety. In fact, this is needed to improve public safety in Massachusetts. Well, things are going the wrong way with those gun laws on the books. Eddie Rivera said he was in his work van when he heard a gunshot ring out near Mass General Hospital on Tuesday morning. He said, I saw a lady rattled. Cops were across the street and yelling out for help. He said, so I ran across the street. I jumped on a guy, straddled his chest. I grabbed his arm. Apparently, he took the cop's gun and shot himself in the femur, I believe. Michael Cox, Boston Police Commissioner, confirmed that the man in question had gotten a hold of the officer's department-issued firearm, suffered a non-life-threatening gunshot wound during a struggle in the street in broad daylight. Rivera said of the suspect, who was a little disoriented, I think he might have been a little mentally unstable. But Eddie Rivera said he helped two officers subdue the man, get him handcuffed. Before a backup arrived at the scene, he said after the guy was subdued, there were 20 to 25 officers out here. He said a huge response. He said, when I was on the ground, I said, I grabbed the guy's wrist. The police officer is 9mm, probably 2 feet away from me. He was asked by Fox 25 in Boston, you know, why did you do this? Why did you run towards the sound of the gunfire? And he said, I heard distress, so I thought I'd lend some assistance. He said, I've got 9 brothers and they used to kick my butt all the time, I guess. So, you know, that mitigated his fear. The officer who was attacked, by the way, is doing okay. And the suspect facing some criminal charges going forward. But in the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. Eddie Rivera there in Boston, Massachusetts, we thank you for your very good deed. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. I want to thank you, as always, for being a part of the program. Now, tomorrow is Opinion Day at the Supreme Court, so we're going to get some decisions. We've got Smith & Wesson versus Mexico. Outstanding. Don't know when the court is going to release that decision. Of course, they don't publicize that ahead of time. And we've got maybe a few more weeks left in the court's term before they skedaddle out of town for their summer recess. So we're going to get Smith & Wesson versus Mexico at some point over the next 3 weeks. And it could be tomorrow when the Supreme Court decides whether or not Mexico can continue its $10 billion lawsuit against many major U.S. gun makers, blaming them for cartel violence, or whether or not that the lawsuit, that junk lawsuit, is precluded by the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act. We will be keeping our eyes open for that decision coming out of SCOTUS. If it does drop tomorrow, we will certainly let you know about it. In fact, we'll probably be talking about it here on Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. But be sure to check out BearingArms.com throughout the day and tomorrow as well. We are keeping you up to date on the latest Second Amendment news and information from all across the nation. And if you like what you see, I would encourage you to become a VIP, VIP Gold, or VIP Platinum member. Use the promo code FIGHT, and you can get 60% off your membership. You'll get all kinds of great benefits at every tier of support, but no matter which tier you choose, you will be supporting the independent pro-Second Amendment journalism that we're doing at Bearing Arms, and we greatly appreciate that. Have a great rest of your Hump Day Wednesday. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Until then, be well, be safe, and be free. We'll be right back.